This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, elegies for the future. In the previous episode of Poetry Off the Shelf, I talked to Luther Hughes, one of five winners of the prestigious Lily Rosenberg Poetry Fellowships for poets between 21 and 31 years old. This week, I talked to another one of the winners, Kathy Zhang. Kathy Zhang is a poet who grew up in the Central Valley of California in Sanger, a farming community just outside of Fresno. Her family is Hmong, like a lot of families in the community, and they resettled there in the early 1980s as refugees. For thousands of years, Hmong people had been living and farming up in the mountains of Laos, but then war broke out in Vietnam, and soon after, the communist North Vietnamese forces invaded Laos. The US got involved, and starting in 1961, the CIA recruited tens of thousands of Hmong fighters into special guerrilla units that would fight the communists. But the Hmong paid a high price. These men and boys died at about 10 times the rate of American soldiers. And once Laos fell to communist forces in 1975, the Hmong were starved, tortured, and executed as retaliation. Hundreds of thousands of people fled. Kathy Zhang's parents were among them.
So when my folks first came to the United States, it was January 1982. Hmm. And initially, my family started out as vegetable pickers. Mom, my parents in particular, it was one of the main ways in which we had income. Aside from, you know, my family was on welfare for a while. So that's how we started off.
Right. And when your parents were not picking vegetables on other people's farms anymore, but they started growing their own vegetables or maybe raising animals, what is it that they did? Like, what did they choose to do?
Sure. So my folks, they mainly chose to do Thai chilies and green beans. Those are kind of like the big crops that are kind of in high demand, usually during the summertime, but also really they send a lot of their produce around the world. So sometimes they ship it to China, Korea, Japan, really all over the place. But I don't really know the way time has worked this year and this pandemic. I'm trying to like remember really when my father first was able to buy land and was able to cultivate and start farming. I would say maybe close to 15 years now. My parents didn't really kind of explain to us how the process all worked. Like, I just kind of remember waking up one day and dad was like, oh yeah, you know, now we don't have to go and be pickers for anybody else anymore. We have land and we can start farming for ourselves. But, you know, my father still required a lot of help. It was just really him and my mom and my stepmom, actually, you know, just the three of them. And polygamy is a very common thing in my culture. So my father actually married my stepmother first before he married my mom.
Yeah.
But it was the three of them and I think an uncle or two who tried to, you know, clear the place of weeds and anything that was overgrown, trying to make the soil. I don't know. I'm not a farmer, so I don't know like the terminologies of how.
Right.
But yeah, so they've been doing that for the last few years, and it's just my dad and my stepmom now. My mom passed in 2016.
Yes.
So once in a while, I think he'll hire some pickers to come and help him harvest because him and my stepmom alone, they're just two people. They're also elderly, and these days they need a lot of help.
How old is your dad now?
So just to backtrack a little, being born in like rural Laos, there really wasn't kind of any documentation on what time or what year you were born, what day.
Right.
A lot of it was just guesstimations of when they were born. So like my mother, she had told me, you know, I was only 15 or 16 when I had your brother. Her firstborn. So I thought, okay, so, you know, my brother Ku, he actually has passed as well. He died in 2014.
Yeah.
I know that he was born the year of 1975, and that was about 2 weeks before the United States officially pulled out of Vietnam and also Laos.
Right.
And so, okay, using that as a kind of historical fact, if she was 15 by the time Ku was born in 1975, then, well, she must have been born in 1960.
Right.
So that being said, when they came to the States, my mother's and my father, they just kind of like gave an arbitrary date, guessing like how old they were. So according to the United States, my dad, I believe, is 76, 77 years old, uh-huh. but I believe he may be younger than that. Like my mom, when she passed, you know, it said she was 60 something years old, 63, 64. But really, I think my mom was only in her 50s. Mm. So it's really weird to me because I grew up in a very big family. So I'm one of 15 brothers and sisters, kids in the family.
Mm-hmm.
So when I try to think of my parents' age, I don't know. I think in my mind as a kid, they were always the same age to me.
Yes. You know,
they don't age. They're not any younger. They're mm-hmm. just themselves. And so,
yeah.
But yeah, my father and my stepmother, they're both in their 70s, at least according to paper.
Right. And so have you ever sensed growing up that there was a divide culturally between the older siblings and the younger siblings, where maybe the older were more Hmong and spoke the language better, and that the younger ones were more American and spoke English better? Or was there no such thing?
I would like to think that it was a little bit of both. So by the time my folks came to this country, there's four of them. So mm-hmm. my Lou at the time, my oldest sister, she was only like maybe 8 or 9 years old when they first came. And then there was my two brothers, my brother Ku, and then my brother Sia. And they were all born in Laos. But the fourth oldest sibling, Lee, she was born in the Thai refugee camp. So by the time they came to the States, there was just four of them.
Right.
So growing up, was there a kind of cultural divide? There totally was. But it was also hard to say, you know, I've actually have tried to ask my older siblings before, like, hey, can you tell me a little bit more about like what your, I don't know, like early experience was like being in this country? Like, what are some of your earliest memories?
Mm-hmm.
But I've not really had a lot of luck being able to sit down and chit chat with them.
Yeah.
It's not that they don't want to share. It's one of those things where like, I don't live at home anymore. You know, I live out of state. Everyone's busy. Everybody has a family. You know, by the time I was born and I came along, my older siblings, you know, my family, they were relatively established in, you know, their routines, their decisions, you know, their assimilation in this country. And so I just kind of really followed whatever my siblings were doing. But there was a mixture of Hmong and English spoken, of course. Hmong, you know, was my first language, but having to go to school, you know, I had to learn English, and I was in ESL for a few years as a kid. And that was a very kind of typical common route for a lot of, I think a lot of Hmong families, really, a lot of Hmong refugees.
Yeah.
So.
Did you like ESL classes?
You know, I just remember being really scared. I was just always scared because I thought to myself, it's not the language that my parents speak at home. It's a language that I knew that my teachers spoke at school. And I thought, oh, okay, I have to learn how to speak this and do this thing because there are all these tests and papers and you have to pass in order to like graduate to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel it's very cloudy now looking back at my childhood memories of being in those classes, but I'm still scared of English till this day. You know, even though I've been writing and using it and speaking it, it's still, I think because it's, when we were younger, you know, my parents really, it's not that they didn't know English. My father could speak it, you know, fluently, but he, wasn't a big fan of using it if he didn't need to. Same thing with my mother's. You know, they were very shy. So anywhere we went, you know, there was a lot of translating on behalf of your parents. And that kind of pressure was very intimidating to me because I never knew if I was obviously translating everything they needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably one of the reasons why I still feel in the back of my like mind really terrified of English, because I feel like I'm always in translation mode.
Does that mean that for you, English has a little bit more of a performative aspect, that you're kind of put on the spot when you speak English?
Absolutely. I still feel that way all the time, even though, again, I use it primarily, you know, every day with my partner. You know, my partner, he's a white guy. I speak English. He speaks English. And, you know, once in a while, I will try to speak Hmong whenever possible. It's hard to do in Ohio because I actually know a couple of Hmong people who live in the city, but I really don't get a lot of opportunities to chat with them, hang out with them. And so the only time I use my native language, you know, is when I'm calling my dad or when I'm back home. Mm-hmm. So it comes back more naturally, but it always surprises me how it comes back.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to get to a poem. It's a poem called Childhood, and it's in Por Anima on page 39.
Okay.
Is there anything that you want to say before you read it?
Let me see. It's very interesting looking at these poems because in my mind, I was so young still, you know, really learning form and trying to figure out influences that worked with me, worked for me, and childhood. Oh my gosh, I'm drawing a blank. I think it's inspired by Gertrude Stein's poems, actually.
How so?
I think I really was just trying to mimic her form, actually. Uh-huh. So, you know, this collection was written during grad school back in 2012, 2013. And so these poems, they feel very strange to me because I feel like a lot of the poems I've been writing have always had an element of grief, of longing. And I think in part because of just my upbringing, my childhood, my parents who were refugees and the stories that they were so kind and generous to share with me. And they were very transparent with their sorrow and with their grief and their grieving process. And I think I really carried that into my poetry. And so I was really trying to explore that. And in some of these poems, and childhood is one of those poems in which I was trying to really capture the strangeness of my life. I mean, for me, it was normal, but to everybody else, if I was trying to explain what my childhood was like, they would just look at me kind of like, I can't really relate or I can't imagine.
Mm-hmm. What I thought was so spectacular about this poem and so ambitious is that you just capture something as unwieldy and as expansive as childhood in five lines. I thought that was incredible. So yeah, if you want to read it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Childhood. Salt, dust, bright life, sudden peach, wet meat, brown seeds, buttonweed, rooster pen, pulled skin and papers with pictures, hands washed in rain, a little sun for a bit of bleach, a little sun for taste, please. Morning again to the bumblebees and loquat tree, toasting leaves and re-seeing all the seasons and facing the different corners of the yard.
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about the sounds in this poem? There are so many E's in this poem, right? Mm-hmm. Peach, meat, seeds, buttonweed, bumblebees, tree, leaves, re-seeing, seasons. They're really a lot. Yeah, can you tell me about that?
You know, I'm always so fascinated with sound and words, the words themselves, how they sound when paired with other words. And so, again, I think in trying to really imitate the very strange meter that is in Gertrude's poetry, I really was trying to take that and apply it to how I feel like what was translated for me in my childhood. So the Hmong language is a very floral, beautiful, poetic language, and there's a lot of rhymes. And I don't pretend to know any riddles or rhymes in Hmong very well. Like I don't speak it very well.
Uh-huh.
I don't speak it formally. In fact, the way I learned how to speak Hmong was very street slang Hmong.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's the language that my parents taught me. And that is to say that very few people actually really know how to speak formal Hmong.
Mm.
My father is one of the only ones, really. My mothers, they are pretty good with the language. But my father, I would say he really is a wordsmith in that he's a poet. You know, he really is. And the way he was raised, you know, my father, he was an orphan when he was really young. And so he was raised by his uncles. But in being raised by other men and his family, he really was forced to learn how to present himself in a kind of fashion that was like, I'm important and I'm here too. And so I feel like perhaps when I wrote this, I was trying to imitate the kind of eloquent way that my father would maybe say something to me. But they came in pieces. And also the poem that I was imitating this after was also kind of in pieces. Somehow I latched onto those strange E sounds, and it just kind of, I don't know, I think it's soothing. And so my childhood wasn't really the happiest. Whenever I do think about it, I really just try to pull the most concrete things that I think really mattered and stayed with me. Mm-hmm. And those weren't always, you know, happy memories either. Many of the times they were really dark memories, but they taught me so much about what it meant to be alive and what it meant to live at the time, and how I think how it continues to inform me. So sounds, surprisingly, has always been very special and important, I think, for me in navigating my own world and poems. This poem is just one example of that.
Yeah. Earlier you said that your parents have always been very transparent about their life in Laos and what happened to them. And if I calculate correctly, if your mother was born in 60, maybe, or around that time, and your father maybe somewhere around that time too, it sounds as if they've not really known their home country without war.
It's true. You know, my father, you know, I think my dad is actually like 10 years older than my mom, but from what I can recall and what I remember from what my folks told me is that there were very few periods in their lives that didn't have war. You know, Laos has long had civil wars, and my dad grew up in the mix of some of that. And so I think that, at least for my father, survival has been the only thing he's ever known. And he carried that all the way through to this country and has imparted that to all of us. And I think that's how, for me, when I started writing poetry, I really gravitated towards that sense of survival. So I don't know how to survive as a quote-unquote traditional Hmong girl in the family, but the English language that I was so terrified of, I somehow latched onto that as my way of navigating my parents' world for them, but also for myself, and trying to figure out what makes sense in my life. How does language get me there to those points where I can grasp and feel like, you know, the world's not going to just slip under my feet?
Yeah. And can you tell me, you know, when you were earlier, you were talking about how English was really a means of survival for you, that you wanted to be good at it in order to be also to be able to help your family. But that also came with pressure. And so I'm wondering, can you tell me when you got to poetry, because poetry is just a very different way of dealing with language, did it become less of a pressure cooker in a way?
Yeah, so I would say it was a different kind of pressure, actually. And because my writing for me largely was, you know, in private, I was writing it, I was reading it at first, you know, it didn't feel like I was being measured or judged too much. But poetry has really long been present in my life in the oral form. You know, I would hear my parents, they would sing their songs a lot. And in the Hmong culture, there's this art form called kutsia, which is just an improvisational ballad, really, that you sing about death and loss, but life as well, and all the things that comes with being a human being. And my parents, they were quite gifted. Not everybody can actually sing their songs, because there is a particular like meter, and there's a rhyme, and again, you have to know the language very well. And anyway, it was an art form that was very common in my household. My parents would sing their songs all the time. It would be a calling, you know, they could be outside farming or getting the clothes off of the line, and then suddenly have this need to just belt out and to just sing what their heart is trying to express. And so having been exposed to that ever since I was little, when I came to poetry, my first exposure, I guess, in terms of literature in a written form was in school. So in the 9th grade, I had an English teacher who had given us a creative writing prompt. we had just finished reading Shakespeare in my class, and one of our early assignments then was to write a sonnet. You know, that was really my first assignment in which I had to imitate, but also really look at form. And I actually loved Shakespeare. I thought, like, wow, what is this weird language? But it's so beautiful. And yet it's not as hard as it sounds. I can actually understand it. And it was one of those really beautiful moments that unlocked for me, like, this is what language on the page can do. So I wrote my sonnet, and you know, I turned that in, and it was a very sad sonnet, I think, because maybe I was channeling a lot of the grief and sadness that my parents had long been trying to deal with. You know, my folks totally have PTSD, but have never had a way of coping with it professionally. And so poetry for me, when we're talking about pressure, when I first started to look at the page and I was writing, there was a kind of catharsis that, you know, that I felt took place. But it, again, a different kind of pressure took on, because, you know, written poetry, written literature is still just kind of really starting to be embraced. And my parents, they probably never imagined that literature could ever have any significance in their lives, or that could have any significance in their children's lives, because they themselves, you know, were not lucky enough to go to school. You had to be really wealthy to go to school in Laos. Hmong people have not been in this country for very long, you know, for just a little over 40 years. And yet already there's so many artists, and there's so many doctors, and so many musicians and writers out there. And so I feel very privileged and very lucky that I can even do this. But suddenly I think I was figuring out, like, wait, are there other Hmong writers? Like, what am I trying to say? What do I need to say? And why?
I'm wondering if you want to read another poem. It's the one called Notes.
Sure. Notes. The direct expression for go is a flat palm. People do this to avoid falling. I trade hemispheres. Hope for the middle. There is no middle. Go missing, and a language goes. A chicken's neck becomes the same refrain. Only we can strike each other down, beat prayers out of our heads. Only we can take us apart. Mother is alive again, and we are unafraid. I palm my throat to keep her from spilling. The knife cannot cut. It could not the first time. How can she break now?
Thank you.
So, yeah, so this poem, I haven't actually read it in a long time. I would say in almost a year now. I'm remembering why I wrote it. So this poem actually started out very differently. And when I went back to revise it, I had included a more recent event at the time that had entered my life. So this happened back in 2012. My mom had... She had planned on going to Laos to visit her ailing father, and her mother, my grandmother, had died just 2-3 years, something like that, before. And being so far away, you know, my mother was actually not able to attend my grandmother's funeral. So that was really hard for her. Anyway, my mom was going to go to Laos. And when my mom did travel, she would bring gifts and money to relatives in Laos. So she had all of that packed and ready to go. And the night before she left, she had told a family friend, I don't know what to call her. Like, I say relative, I say auntie, you know, anybody who was just in our family circle, we just kind of call them, you know, friend or family. Anyway, she made a stop at her friend's house the night before her flight. And it turned out that this friend had different motives, and ended with my mom in a very brutal attack, where she was imprisoned against her will in this person's home. She was almost robbed of her items, and she had received several lacerations to her body. and how my mom survived, it's still mind-blowing to me, actually. Like, I try all the time. I don't know why I do this to myself, and maybe this is just the poet in me, but yeah. I question and I rethink and I re-see that scene a lot. That was a very strange and dark time in my life when I was revising this poem.
Did your mom end up going then to Laos, or was she not able to?
Unfortunately, she was not able to. She was in the hospital for overnight, really just for stitches and the like, but she was pretty battered up. It was a very traumatic experience for all of us. And so when I wrote this poem, I don't know why, but I paired the one thing I knew the most that involved a neck and a knife, and it was killing chickens. A chicken's neck becomes the same refrain. Only we can strike each other down. And I'm thinking my mom was almost killed in that way. And the imagery of the chicken, you know, chickens are so common, I think, in a lot of Hmong people's lives. They are seen as spiritual guides in our culture. And so, you know, there have been many sacrificial ceremonies, I guess, so to speak, where a chicken is involved and we consume it, but we also honor it because we know that its life is going to guide and look after, you know, our spirit. So that image comes in because a lot of my childhood, I remember, well, frankly, killing a lot of chickens with my mother's.
Yeah.
So I think that when I went back and revised this poem, I could not stop thinking about my mom's attack and how she had survived.
Yeah. And how old were you when this happened?
So this was actually just in 2012. And so I was in grad school.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, the way I had found out that this had happened was my younger sister had called me in the middle of the night. And I remember it was like 2-3 in the morning, and I picked up, and, you know, she was crying to me and telling me, "Kathy, I have bad news." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, what is this?" You know, I thought I was dreaming, but she's like, "Kathy, somebody attacked mom. And we're on the way to the hospital right now." And at this point, we weren't sure if my mother had, you know, died, had bled to death, or it was a panicked phone call. And it was the most surreal morning. I remember, I think I had a poetry workshop that day, and I had emailed my professor, like, "I'm so sorry, I don't know how to say this, but something horrible happened to my mom and I can't come in." And, you know, everyone was so generous, you know, at the time, like, "Oh yeah, sure, do what you gotta do, it's okay." So I was fortunate that I, even though I felt so alone in Montana writing poetry and being Hmong, I was lucky that, you know, my colleagues were there. And
So
2012, and it's hard to believe because, you know, my mom, she's been gone since 2016. And you know, my mom, she died in a car crash. And so that was a whole other, you know, kind of grief, in which I thought, well, my mom already nearly died in this really violent way by a family friend, and then she actually dies in a car crash, and once again she was by herself. She died alone in the countryside. So the grief poems that I've been writing, and even in this book, when I go back to revisit, I felt like I had long been writing elegies for my mom.
Yes. I've noticed that too, and it's quite haunting. I was really wondering, I mean, when I read this phrase, "The knife cannot cut."
The knife cannot cut. It could not the first time. How can she break now?
And then I read that the car that she was in did break in two, although she did not.
Correct.
Okay, so what I was wondering is, do you have a sense that in a poem you can know things that aren't possible to know yet? That there's almost like a loop in time that the future can already have happened?
Yeah, I think, yeah, poetry is weird. It's weird like that, where I feel like there is a strange permission that the page somehow can tell you, you know, you can query that, you can write that. And even if the time whether it's happened or whether it's not happened. I don't know how it happens that I'm like able to process a feeling or maybe an event that hasn't happened. It just does. Sorry, I'm not sure if I was fully answering your question.
No, of course. I mean, also, you know, I never want to really have an answer to my question. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I'm more interested in what you have to say than in what I have to ask, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
But I was wondering, since you said that in your earlier poems that you were already writing pre-grieving almost your mother, when she did die in 2016, were you afraid of the power of your own poetry?
You know, I do know that I was afraid, and it was the fact that with the little information I had had, that my mother had died in a car crash, and I had heard that she was by herself, and that the woman who had killed her, you know, left with hardly a scratch. The first thing I thought about immediately, actually, that I was so terrified and so afraid, was my mother's spirit. I was trying to think, what state is her spirit in? Does she know that she's gone? Or does she think she's still on that road driving? What has happened? What has transpired? How does time work in death? And I was having all these questions that I clearly, you know, nobody could answer for me, nor could there ever be any, I don't know, I guess concrete answers given. But I was so afraid for the state of her spirit, because I knew my mother was a very fragile woman. She was strong. She was not afraid of a lot of different things, but for some reason I knew that when she lived, she was afraid of death. My mother always tried to take care of her body. You know, she was a medicine woman. She was a healer. She was a shaman. So caring and healing others was a duty that she had been blessed with by the heavens. And you know, though I say this, I say this as somebody who grew up around animism, but never for myself lived based off of that culture. I just knew that for my parents, they believed in that world and in that realm and how it worked for them. So even though, you know, I grew up not quite believing it for myself, I felt panicked and terrified for my mom's spirit and the state of her body. Yeah, actually, you know, I kept thinking, the first thought everybody had was, what does her body look like? What does it look like? Because looking at the pictures of that car, what did her body look like?
Yeah. Do you feel differently about her spirit now?
I do feel different. Definitely, you know, since 2016, I've been kind of loosely tracking my grief in that I know that the first 2 years were really hard. They were really dark. I was just very unhappy, you know, everything, you know, so there was a sense of this survivor's guilt that I've always felt my whole life anyway, with my parents and knowing what they had survived and gone through. You know, they survived genocide, they survived refugee camps, they survived coming here, and they managed to live here for a good while before, you know, this had happened to my mom. And so I remember many people telling me at the beginning, time heals all wounds, or with time you will be able to, I don't know, I guess not be as sad, to put it frankly. And it was very frustrating to hear these condolences, or these kinds of condolences, because it was almost like a way of silencing my grief and not wanting to witness the horrific death that my mom had gone through. And I think a large part of this really strange culture in the United States anyway about death is that, you know, it's so taboo. We must not talk about it. We can't think of only the good things. And it always felt very unfair, because I thought, well, I would argue that there were very few good things in my memory that I had of my mom or my mom of her own life. I don't pretend to know fully, of course, my mom's life, but I know from what I saw, she was a very unhappy woman and, you know, very troubled and just didn't have a way to healthily process her grief or any of the events that had unfolded in her life. And for me, I don't know how I commune with her, but I think I still do it, you know, in my poems when I write to her, when I think of her, especially as I'm trying to work on my second poetry manuscript, mm-hmm. which are all poems. They're all dedicated to my mom. And these poems are exploring how I've navigated my grief and or how I haven't.
Yeah.
My grief does feel different. I don't know how to, I suppose you could say the first 2 years, it felt like pure rage. But now, you know, it's been 4 years and I feel like the rage is a little calmer, but, it's still lurking. And if I just give in to it, if I just think about it over and over and over again, about the call, about meeting my mom at the coroner's and seeing her body before me and seeing that she did not look like the mother I remembered or the, and you know, where I started to, the grief has been so strange because it's made me question a lot if my mother was a real person, because somehow I went from knowing someone to not knowing someone at all because mm-hmm. they're gone. And, you know, you have the memories and you have the pictures, but they also betray your very ability to understand reality. And so I go back and forth a lot between being gentle and then being full on raging in my poems. But that's something that I feel like I'm just going to have to keep sorting out and figuring out until I'm able to ride off that wave. And I don't know. I think it's going to be a lifelong experience of letting go, accepting, and then not accepting, and then letting go, and then not, mm-hmm. you know, it's a back and forth.
Yeah. When you were seeing your mom at the coroner's, you said that she didn't look like the mom you knew. What was different?
I mean, just the physical damage that she had sustained. Oh. And I knew it was her body, of course. But the part that was actually heartbreaking was when I was there, the little tag on her foot said Jane Doe, because at the time they had not been able to identify who she was. Mm-hmm. And I just remember that moment when I saw that tag, you know, like already thinking my mom died all alone. Nobody can attest whether or not it was quote unquote her fault or the woman who killed her. And then so she's nameless as well. And it was a very painful moment for me to kind of recognize all of that in one moment. And a few years ago, I had ordered the coroner's report on my mom's body because it was, you know, a car accident. They had to do an investigation. They had to do a report on her body. And I remember actually asking my partner if he could order that report on behalf of me just so that I could have it. But I didn't know that I wanted to read it. I actually wanted to, but then when it did arrive, I actually was so terrified. I still haven't opened it because someone, a poet actually I had met at McDowell when I was working on this manuscript, had said to me, "Hey, I did the same thing too when my sibling had died. And when I opened that report, Kathy, it's a door. You cannot, you know, unopen it. When it's open, you can't unsee it. You can't unknow the pain that the body had endured in their final moments." And it kind of, it was scary, but it encouraged me to wait because the poet had suggested to me, you know, if you want to read it, you can, but there may not really be a proper time or a good knowing time to ever do it. So when you do it, just know that you can't unknow that information.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm still sitting on that email.
Yeah.
As I'm working on this book, actually, I've been wondering, do I want to open that PDF Mm-hmm. Or do I just imagine as I have been anyway?
Mm-hmm. It's true what you say, that there are certain things you cannot unknow once you know them, once you see them, and then they end up replacing what was there before. And so since you haven't opened this report yet, what is a memory of your mother that you like to remember? What is a moment maybe where you felt like she was most herself, or she was in her element, or you felt close to her?
I would say probably the many hot summers that I spent with her in the fields picking vegetables. And even though it's not, I guess, the most flattering image, in that here you see an immigrant or a refugee out in the fields working for just pennies and some dollars, the situation was always cruel and hard. But for some reason, my mom was very proud of how fast of a picker she was. She was very proud of the physical labor, of every dollar she earned. She was so proud of that. And even though it was not, you know, it wasn't the only way she could have made money, but it was the way that she chose, because my parents are farmers. They come from a farming life, and the land is a very special kind of place for them to be. And, you know, being with the soil, being with the dirt and the water and the plants and harvesting and cultivating, that made a lot of sense for my parents, and that it was a common form of surviving. And because, you know, they weren't quote unquote surviving anymore the way they had to in Laos, but it was a different kind of survival in this country. And, you know, they took to the lands. And so my mom, I think my favorite memory of her really is being by her side and sharing that pain and that load of the California sun, and you know, being just so warm and sweaty from all the heat and the exhaustion. I think that's one of my favorite memories. You know, I have others, but I think she was mostly herself. She knew how to work the land, I guess, is what I was saying.
Do you want to read the poem where your mother is in the fields picking chili peppers?
Yes. Pork rinds, watered rice. It seemed a powerful thing, my mother being a chili picker, withstanding the burn of broken chilies, hotly licking her fingers, stomaching the only meal for the day, pork rinds and watered rice, a warm can of Pepsi, a bite of a Thai chili plucked along the way, the summer heat to melt the rest of her being, the day ending with 440 pounds, her pocket stuffed with $66 in cash. In late evenings, she'd remove from underneath the carpet flap of the bedroom floor a thick white envelope, not so mysterious, my little self waiting for her to count, to look over, eyes instructing. I had never thought her lonely for the act, perhaps when it seemed her body was her only friend, the way she spoke to those hands, unlike with me. I'd watch her undress, think only of her torso, how tired she looked, how much I loved her, the nightly ritual in the bathroom, talking to her hands, the sound of running water to mute the conversation.
Thank you. This is really an extraordinarily moving poem. I had never thought her lonely for the act, perhaps when it seemed her body was her only friend, the way she spoke to those hands, unlike with me. Can you remember the way your mom moved? Because it's such a hard thing to remember.
Yeah, I actually do try to remember and think a lot about how she did move. because one of the first things, you know, I noticed, of course, when I saw my mother on the table in the coroner's room was that it was, she wasn't moving. It was the first time I'd seen her so still. And my mother was a busybody. You know, she never stayed in one place, could not, you know, you would tell her to rest after a long day of doing something and she would sit down on the couch and then, you know, sometimes she would nap maybe for 20 minutes, but then she'd get up and right away already, you know, tending to chores or tending to her garden or doing something in the kitchen, pots and pans, you know, just banging. And she was always moving. And so actually I think I try to capture that when I can, but so much of the poems anyway, lately, I think there's very little movement. And instead, my mom appears to be more just really an object. And so I think in my poems, she does not move very much, but in my mind, how I remember her, she is always on the go and she's always moving.
That's beautiful. Do you think it's, I mean, this is impossible to say, of course, but do you think the fact that she's not moving in your poems, is that just for now? Do you think that in future poems, she'll be there moving?
It's possible. Yeah, I think that my current poems really just reflect my current state of grief and how I'm still trying to translate her loss for myself. So yeah, I would imagine that that would probably transform and change over time.
Yeah.
But the day that I had found out she died, I wrote a poem. It was something that I had to do and that I needed to do. I had a moment in which I had, you know, cried and howled in anguish and I was just so confused. And then I can't remember if I hand wrote this poem or if I grabbed my laptop, but I just remember frantically writing because I needed to, because it was like, yeah. Oh my gosh, my mom, how do I communicate with her? How do I reach her? And then I just started scribbling away. And it became actually something that I really wanted to do. You know, nobody forced me to write these poems for my mom. Nobody said, you have to write, or if you don't write, you're not a poet. You know, nobody, it was a moment that confirmed for me that I was meant to write poetry for the rest of my life. All my life, this is what I was meant to do. And even after, you know, a horrible incident that happened to my mom in 2012 and you know, and even years before that, you know, unhappy moments that had happened, poetry was always there for me. And so it felt very natural again that it was still there and it never went away. It wasn't harder to write poetry because of her death. It became easier. It became more of, I don't know, it was just like air. It was just there and I took it and I keep taking. And that's what I feel like I'm doing when I write, is that I keep taking. And I don't know when I'm supposed to not take anymore. But for now, it's like the only way for me to kind of be okay with my mom's death is that I must also be okay that I'll be writing about it for a while.
Kathy Zhong is one of the five winners of this year's Lily Rosenberg Poetry Fellowships, together with Isabella Borgeson, Saray Jarrell Johnson, Darius Simpson, and Luther Hughes, who I talked to last time. Kathy Zhong is the author of Por Anima, her debut collection from 2015, and three chapbooks, Ode to the Far Shore, Dear Hour, and Elegies, which won the 2013 Merriam Frontier Award. Kathy Zhong also received a Vermont Studio Center Fellowship, a Roxane Gay Fellowship in Poetry from Jack Jones Literary Arts, the Nadia Eisenberg Fellowship at McDowell, and an Individual Excellence Award from the Ohio Arts Council. She lives in Columbus, Ohio with her partner and dog, and she's currently working on a book of poems dedicated to her mother. To find out more about her work, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.